Patrick J. Lamb is founder of Valerum Group, a pioneering law firm in business litigation based in Chicago, Illinois. He has long been a proponent of alternative fees. Listen as Ed and Patrick discuss the definition, concept, and implementation of alternative fees.
Patrick, thanks for joining us today on Law Biz Podcasting. It's a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to have a chat with you once again.
Thanks, Ed. It's always one of the highlights of my day when we have a chance to visit.
Well, you are a leading proponent of alternative fees, and I think my first question for our listeners ought to be, what do we mean when we talk about alternative fee arrangements? What's a definition for them, and how can they be used?
Well, that's one of the great, theoretical debates going on right now. There's one end of the spectrum that would say anything that is different than a firm's standard hourly rack rate is an alternative fee. Personally, I believe that anything that relies on timekeeping as a way of determining value is billable hour and billable hour related, and that an alternative would be something which is not tied to the amount of time spent on a matter. So, for example, a fixed fee, a contingency fee, a capped fee still has hourly rubric, but is much closer to the alternatives that I'm talking about that tend to align firms and their clients' economic interests. And that's really, at the end of the day, I think what the definition should be. If the fee in place or the structure in place makes the firm's interest and the client's interest the same from an economic standpoint, then I think what you have is an alternative to the standard hourly system.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, I had not quite thought about this before, is the concept of timekeeping. Are you suggesting that with the alternative fee approach, whether it be fixed fee or otherwise, that lawyers do not have to keep track of their time?
Again, one of these interesting debates. As our practice is that we continue to keep track of time, we do so really for two reasons. One is a safeguard. If a client decides they really want to see what we did, it's an easy way to provide that information and be transparent about the work that you're doing and how much effort and time you're investing in. And until people are completely comfortable getting away from it, I think it's safer to have that to be able to share. The other thing is that it's important information that we use in pricing our work. When we get the next matter, like one that we've done, we want to be able to go back and mine that data so that our pricing efforts are informed by our prior work.
Well, I've got two questions then for you. If you're keeping track of time for purposes of future pricing, aren't you saying, in effect, that your future pricing has some relationship to the time you spent?
Well, it's not.
In other words, you're really not basing your pricing on the value to the client.
Well, I think that there's a misnomer. There's a difference between alternative fees and the kinds of things that we're doing and what I would call pure value billing, which is where you say, what is this worth to the client? Because in a marketplace, the client's answer to that question frequently is going to be by looking at what your competitors would charge them. So the cost to the client of various options is always going to be a consideration. But if I know that our cost of doing something is, you know, between, say, $100,000 and $150,000, that amount of cost that we would incur is going to inform how we price it out. Because we can't be completely unmindful of our cost structure in undertaking work. And if that number isn't competitive with either other quotes the client is getting or the client doesn't agree that that's a reasonable value, then we may not be the right firm in that circumstance. But there's always a component of time and effort that I think has to be considered, and it's one of many elements that we would take a look at.
When you talk about the cost of the matter, and 90%, say, maybe 70% of the cost is really the cost of the lawyer involved. I mean, real estate occupancy cost has a cost factor, and support staff and the like and so forth and so on. But the bulk of the cost really is the lawyer. When you figure out your pricing, like you said, maybe it cost you $150,000, are you using a per-hour cost for the lawyer times the number of hours the lawyer spent on the last similar matter in order to come up with your concept that it cost you $160,000 on that prior matter, and the pricing of the lawyer is based on what you're actually paying the lawyer, or are you selecting an arbitrary billable hour rate to come up with that figure?
It's much more the former than the latter. We don't look at hours times rates for any purpose in pricing or anything else, including evaluating whether we had a winning fee relationship or one that was not winning. What we would look at is, for example, to say, okay, this prior matter took two lawyers, say roughly 80% of their working commitment through, you know, 8 months, and we know that two lawyers need to contribute X dollars to our, you know, to meet our monthly cost structure, and so that, you know, that then you do the 80% times that number, and you can kind of come up with a number. Now, because people can work more or less at any given time, there's a way to be flexible with that. So they say, look, that other matter was one that was, you know, the lawyer on the other side was a scorched earth lawyer, so we're going to go down because we don't think we have the same kind of scorched earth lawyer in this newer case. And so let's think more at 70%, and you know, there's a certain you know, comfort level, and it's almost an intuition you get on a number. Are we in the right area here? And then the other kind of component of this is, what's the upside? So if I'm going to shave my number closer on the what we get paid each month, then I want a higher upside so that our successes get rewarded a bit more for taking that additional risk. So there's some give and take in terms of risk that you take versus reward that you're able to achieve, and you know, I think clients appreciate sometimes having an ability to say, no, I'd rather kind of stay within a narrower band, so I'll pay you more each month and have less riding on the outcome. And other clients take a different approach.
Sure. So that's when you have sort of a range that you're offering the client. But in order to figure out what that range is, you're trying to really determine what the cost is to you, and that cost is based on the time and the literal cost of the lawyer to the firm, not on any arbitrary market billing rate, if I'm
correct.
Hearing you correctly.
Correct. It's not the actual per lawyer cost, but you know, the cost of that individual lawyer, but it's the, what I would define it as, is that lawyer's expected contribution to our monthly nut. And I'll be honest, there's a bit of cushion built into that monthly nut, not an awful lot, but I mean, we're not operating on a 0% margin on a monthly basis, because that would be unsound for those, you know, if we have a month where we're slow and all of a sudden we don't have enough money to pay the bills, we've just, you know, really kind of set ourselves back. So we do have some cushion built in, but not very much. It's certainly nothing on the order of magnitude that law firms typically operate.
Right. Well, I mean, what I was trying to get at is not what your ultimate price to the client is, but rather trying to understand how you get to the point where you truly understand what the cost of operating is, because most law firms, in my experience, really don't understand what their cost is of opening the light switch each morning.
Right, and I think that our understanding of that is certainly better than at any firm I've been at before, and we've spent a fair amount of time with our financial people, you know, being educated as to how to make those calculations and what our actual cost structure is.
Okay. Well, one thing is clear from what you've said is that the alternative fees concept that we're working with is something different than the value-added approach that some people are advocating for determining fees for the client. So you're taking a more hands-on approach to it and not just letting the client say, well, this is how much it's worth to me.
Well, indirectly we do that by virtue of our value adjustment line on our bill, which, as I think we've talked about before, our bill is a proposed fee, and then we invite the client to mark the bill up or down to reflect the value that they think that they've received by virtue of our service.
Mm-hmm.
So they can write in a new number, and whether it's up or down, that number becomes the amount that is actually due from the client. But it's different than what is, I would call, traditionally looked at as value billing, which is to not look at all at the cost of providing the service and simply say, what is this issue worth to the client from a value standpoint, and work from that number, and then if it fits within the firm's cost structure, you know, you go ahead and do the work, and if it doesn't, you know, then you have either adjustments to make or you have to decline the engagement.
Well, let me ask you along those lines, how you structure your fee agreement. What kind of language would you use to give you the flexibility you're talking about? A moment ago when I asked you about timekeeping, one of the things I had in mind was that if there, in fact, is a fee dispute, one of the things that state bar disciplinary boards and trial courts litigating such matters turn to almost instinctively with knee-jerk reaction is what your time records show, so that if, in fact, you did not keep time records, you would have to either reconstruct or, you know, sort of pass. And if you have time records, I'm not sure what the result would be if your agreed fee was, say, $1,000, and you could add whatever number of zeros you want to it. But, in fact, the time it took you was only $100 worth of time, and I use worth in quotes. You know, is that unconscionable or unreasonable fee for the work done? And I think somewhat along the same lines here is if there is this adjustment that's possible, how do you reflect that in a fee agreement that's enforceable?
Well, if we had a fee dispute with a client where the client, for example, didn't pay, I think we would probably not be able to enforce an agreement because of this value adjustment line. It does give the client the right to make an adjustment to zero, and simply refusing to pay would
be the equivalent of going to zero.
Exactly. And so, you know, we have to live both ways with that, you know, the risk of doing that. So I wouldn't, you know, I'm not designing a fee structure or fee agreements with the idea of how would I enforce them if the client didn't want to pay, because at that point, the relationship is terminal, and you know we need to go our separate ways. And the value adjustment line really becomes the canary in the coal mine, so that if we have an issue, it's going to flag it sooner rather than later. Our fee agreements are typically very, very simple, which is you'll pay us X dollars, certain percentage or a certain specific number of dollars will be held back into a bucket which will grow, and at the end of the matter, you'll have discretion over whether we've earned that or not, so that we fully empower our client to control our fee. And, our belief and hope is that by demonstrating that level of trust in them, they will feel comfortable trusting their work to us. And so far, knock on wood, so good.
Well, let me ask you the next question then, which is, in connection with alternative fees, is there any type of matter where it doesn't work? Or put in a more positive framework, when is it that we should use the alternative fees that we're talking about today?
We do only litigation, and so I don't want to say that there's some transactional area where the hourly rate wouldn't be appropriate. I just haven't thought through all those areas, and I'm not familiar enough with the nuances to be able to offer that informed view. But in the litigation area, I'm not sure that there is an area that isn't amenable to alternative fee billing. One of the toughest areas would be where there's tremendous unknowns at the very beginning. So the shape of the case, the full nature of the dispute is not known. And there's really two ways to do that, and we've done it literally both ways, which is to say, in large measure depends on whether we have a new relationship with a client or it's an existing client. For existing clients, we say, look, we'll do this work, and when we get to a point where we'll understand, we understand what the dynamics are, what the real scope of this is, we'll scope the work, we'll build in the work we've done, and we'll quote you a price for that includes prior work. And clients typically are fine with that. If they're not fine with that, or we have a new client that we don't have a track record with, we'll say, look, we will do this hourly as a backstop until such time as we can figure it out and agree on a price. So we're protected by getting some amount of money up front, but we're not we're not going to do that for the life of the case. It's going to be kind of a short order, short term situation where we have to kind of fall back on that because everybody knows it and it's easy, and then we'll get to an understanding about the nature and scope of the work and reach a fee agreement at that point. And then what we've done on a couple of occasions when we've had to do that is we'll just fold what we've been paid into that agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So typically works out without any real problem.
Well, assuming that you've got all this in place then, in terms of what you're doing, but now you're looking at somebody who probably hasn't done this before, how would you either suggest that they get started, or alternatively, how would you suggest that they go from the theory of alternative fees into the practice of implementing it?
Tough question, and it's a tough answer because there is no risk-free way of doing this. I mean, the whole point of alternative fees is to remove risk from the client side, which is the risk they have on cost-plus billing under the billable hour model, and put it put the risk on the lawyer side. So getting a firm, detailed understanding about your cost structure is probably step one. Step two is looking at your historic data on cost of various kinds of matters, just so you have a feel for those things, and you understand that if your firm operates at a 45% margin, that you have 45% profit really built into those particular numbers. And so, you know, whatever your costs were in a former matter, that really is a point of downward departure, not upward departure. And then you have to, you know, start looking for a lot of different, what I call vectors on a matter, things that will point to a price, your experience. How much do I think this is likely to cost based on, you know, being around the block a few times? What would a granular budget create in terms of a number, and how does that compare with my intuition? If I do it on the number of people per month, knowing their costs and what they contribute, how much does that suggest? And these vectors tend to congregate in a, you know, relatively narrow area, which would suggest a number. But at the end of the day, Ed, there's really no substitute for going through it, and you have to be prepared to have cases where you're wrong and you lose money, or at least your recovery is not at the level that you think it should be to support your cost structure.
Well, I suppose there's two reasons for going to alternative fees. One, obviously, is to connect more and better with the client. But another is, hopefully, for the lawyer to be able to make more money. When I've coached lawyers who are on the hourly system, billable hour system, it seems to me that they are undervaluing themselves, at least as compared to the marketplace of what other lawyers are charging. How is it in the alternative fee approach the lawyer can benefit, can improve his margin or his profitability?
The whole point of the fixed fee version of this, or the modified fixed fee, is creating a strong incentive for the lawyer to reduce the amount of time it takes to achieve a specified result. So, for example, if you can use early case assessment tools, early mediation, early efforts in front of a judge to encourage the parties to resolve, and I mean to resolve at an appropriate level, one that you'd be able to reach after, you know, substantial investment in the case, then you're taking your transactional costs out of the equation, and you're not adjusting your fee downward. So, you know, for example, if we operate at a break-even standpoint on a case, and we have this holdback bucket, and we get a great result, and the client decides to multiply the bucket, or even pay us just the bucket, all of that's profit to us. So the incentives to achieve results and the incentives to achieve good results quickly are huge. And most lawyers, when they get past the pattern and practice that they have followed for years and years, have the creative capabilities of figuring out ways to get to a good solution sooner rather than later. And it's kind of tapping into those creative impulses that typically will lead to the ability to substantially improve your margin.
Well, one of the things you say is that the client has the right at the end of the bill to go up, stay the same, or go down. And I suppose that obviates the need to answer my next question, which would be, under normal circumstances, if you charge a client $1,000, even if the client agrees to pay $1,000, but based on time, it costs you only $100 to perform the service. Is there any obligation on your part under the rules of professional conduct to say to the client, no, don't pay me more, or you've paid me, but I have to refund now because we took so little time? Is there any connotation there, or are we just talking about two totally different worlds?
I think to a large degree it's two totally different worlds, but let me offer kind of two very quick examples of the extremes. If the case for, you know, we agree to take a case for $1,000, and while the file's being sent over, the client gets a call from the other side and the matter resolves to the client's satisfaction. Our attitude is we added zero value to that outcome. Don't pay us anything. On the other hand, if the case resolves in 10 minutes because I'm able to pick up the phone and through my relationship with the other side able to achieve a resolution that the client has deemed desirable, then my answer to the client, if you say, well, it only took you 10 minutes, is, well, look, you agreed to pay X. Why should you care how long it took me to achieve this result that you were happy with? Why do you begrudge me essentially a windfall? On the other hand, if you're that concerned about it, then use the value adjustment line. But the reality is that and there are clients, I think, that fall into that second category. They really don't like the idea of the law firm receiving a windfall. But it's one of those things where you have to say that you got exactly what you bargained for. We had every risk that this matter wouldn't resolve for the $1,000 and that we'd be over $1,000 and not getting any more money. And you know, we wouldn't have asked you to start paying us more, so the fact that we did it for less, you know, should be a win for us kind of thing, a good result for us. So, again, that falls into that trust category discussion that we had. You ultimately, if you're going to have a long-term client relationship, everybody needs to be comfortable that people are being fair with each other. And if you don't feel you're being treated fairly, you know, then I think you need to find a different client, and the client needs to find a different lawyer.
It sort of reminds me of the apocryphal story of Edward Bennett Williams, where a client called him and asked him for some advice, needed some help, and Williams hung up. Then he called somebody in Congress, 5 minutes, got the appropriate information he needed and or the lobby effect that he wanted, called the client back and said, okay, it's done. Sent him a bill for $25,000. The client says, what's this for? And sort of what you're saying, well, you got what you asked for. You know, you saved millions of dollars because of what I was able to do. So why are you complaining about a pittance of only $25,000?
Right. And I've also heard that story, and I forget who, might have been Clark Clifford, revised the bill and sent it, a bill with two line items on it that said, you know, making the call to so-and-so, you know, $500, knowing who to call and what to say, $24,500. You know, again, I think people have spent so long dealing with the billable hours that they have, you know, forgotten that there's a safer way, and, you know, you buy an insurance policy, sometimes the insurance company doesn't have to pay, but you're still buying the insurance policy because it's a smart, you know, smart business move.
Right.
And that's really kind of the move, you know, the fixed fee move is. It's like buying an insurance policy against, you know, a large overcharge, in a wayward matter, and you're protecting yourself against that, and we're underwriting that insurance policy.
I had not heard that metaphor before, but I like it. It puts it, I think, in the appropriate context. Well, to sort of recap, if I heard you correctly, how to get from the theory to the practice is first understanding what your cost level is, and then that takes a great deal of effort and intuition, I suspect. Can't just do it as a new lawyer on the block. You've got to have done it a few times, but then to actually implement it. And one of the things. And you'll have some successes and you'll have some not so successful arrangements. But one of the things that you said that makes me wonder is that you said a long-term relationship. And I'm wondering if this works better and maybe even exclusively with clients that you do have a long-term relationship, that you do have a history with, the clients who are in the corporate world who have multiple litigation matters that want to retain you on a regular ongoing basis. Is that a sort of undercurrent that I'm hearing from you?
First of all, I think everything works better when you have an ongoing relationship with a client. But in terms of the fixed fee world, kind of picture it in this way. If the average cost of a case is $1,000, and it's based on, you know, let's say 10 other cases, that means some were above 1,000, some were below 1,000. If you wanted to try and help the client lower their average cost, though, it would be hard to go in on any one case and say, I'll move very far from $1,000, because you'd always have the risk that it would be the outlier that cost $2,000. But if you get 10 cases, you know, you're somewhat, and I think significantly, protected against the outlier up by virtue of being able to have in that mix somewhere the outlier that would bring the average down. And so with multiple cases, or, you know, whether together or spread out over time, the wins and losses on any individual case will tend to offset each other, and you can look at it from a more macro level. So the slide I use when I'm making presentations is a pool, a glass of water, and an eye droplet of water. and if you want to save water, you know, you can save in each circumstance, but the amount that you're able to save is going to be dramatically different by virtue of the size of the body of water you're starting with. So,
all right, let me ask you our final question for today, and that is, how can we determine if the alternative fee arrangement with a given client has worked, is successful? And I guess I need to ask you to first define successful before you answer the question. Is it successful from the client's perspective in terms of lowering their legal cost, or is it successful from the lawyer's perspective in terms of retaining a client or making money, et cetera?
Well, the client could have any number of objectives in deciding to enter into an alternative fee arrangement. Saving costs is one, but that's not by any stretch of the imagination the only one. The certainty of cost is probably more significant these days, as law departments and the CFO's office seem to have become much more intimate with one another. Providing your company controller the budget certainty is really a huge benefit, and frequently people will say that's more important than even getting a lower cost, because the controller people hate surprises. So the key from the client side is understanding what the specific objectives are, and then at the end of the matter, being able to evaluate your accomplishment of those objectives. And like anybody else from a lawyer side, you know, everybody's in this to make a profit, and so your ability to measure profit is important. I tend to think that looking at any one matter is kind of a hard way to do that. So you're going to look at it from a practice standpoint. Has this practice been successful? Do I have enough cases here where I'm, you know, seem to be you know, getting high margins on my work? So those things will, I think, become fairly apparent early on after you get, you know, a couple of matters under your belt.
Well, Patrick, thank you, as always, for joining us today and giving us another perspective on alternative fees and how they impact both the client and the lawyer.
Well, as always, Ed, it's a great pleasure talking with you, and thank you for some really interesting and probing questions.
You have been listening to a LawBiz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about LawBiz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.